Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com, and I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hutterton Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Well, good afternoon on this beautiful, and I mean beautiful, Friday, October 6th. It actually feels like it's, what, August? I mean, this has really been a beautiful day, and I hope you've been able to appreciate it, because unfortunately, it's not going to continue. Tonight, mainly patchy fog after midnight, otherwise mostly cloudy, low of around 62 degrees, so it's really not cold or really cool, very, very warm for this time of year. But what's happening tomorrow? Well, we're going to have patchy fog early in the morning, and then otherwise it'll be mostly cloudy, and then gradually becoming sunnier with a high of about 85 degrees. So tomorrow is the nice day. On Sunday, we can expect a chance of showers, mostly cloudy, high of about 80 degrees. So tomorrow, 85. Tomorrow night, as I said, there's a chance of showers, about 40% chance later. And then on Sunday, there is a 50% chance of showers, again, about 80 degrees, but the about a 40 to 50%, at least 50%, now they're saying, precipitation, but it's going to be minimal, less than 10th of an inch. Again, Sunday night, there should be showers, low of around 65 degrees, but about an 80% chance of rain. Now, they call it showers, but again, it's only a quarter to a half of an inch in this area. Unfortunately, Columbus Day, for those of you who have off, there's about an 80% chance of showers, and then into Monday night, again, likely showers, 60%, and into Tuesday, about a 50% chance of showers. Not as warm Monday and Tuesday, in the high 70s, and into mostly cloudy on Tuesday night. So, unfortunately, for everybody who is expecting a long weekend, we've had such beautiful weather, but now we can expect rain this weekend. And I think the rain is coming probably from the Midwest. They've had rain followed by fairly nice weather, but pretty much rain. And if anyone is going north, as I plan on doing, into Vermont, they're also expecting rain. So that's the weather for the weekend. So what else is happening? Well, we're here today. It's the law. I'm Pat Smits, and those of you who know me know that I'm an attorney here in Hunterdon County. My practice is limited to family law matters, but I try to bring you up to date on Fridays as to what else is happening in the law. So let me do that. What is happening? Well, I think if you listen to the news, you've heard that Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill in California that is designating California as a sanctuary state. There's a lot of misunderstanding about what that means. We have sanctuary cities around the country, and the people that are very opposed to this say that the police are protecting undocumented persons in the country. Governor Brown and what the other cities are basically saying is no. What they're doing is they're targeting dangerous criminals, and targeting criminals, whether they're citizens here on green cards or undocumented, and that they're police officers and they want to do police work, not do immigration work. And that is really the difference. Should the police be involved in helping the INS pick up illegal, I say illegal aliens, it really is undocumented people. So it is basically the cities, and now the state of California, saying that they're going to protect law-abiding residents, whether they're citizens here on green cards or undocumented. And they want to focus their efforts in getting rid of the criminal element. And, of course, this is pretty incredible that it's California that is the first state and maybe the only state who will that will sign such a law, because I don't know if it's any longer, but certainly in the past, most of the people coming across the Mexican border, whether they were from Mexico or any of the other Central American countries, probably most of them stayed in California. Of course, more recently, there have been migrations all over the country. And, in fact, right here in Hunterdon County, we have many undocumented residents, hardworking. I mean, I certainly have represented some people in court, and they're hardworking. They're raising their children, but they're always living in fear that somehow they will be deported back to Mexico. And, of course, we've talked about the Dreamers Act and the moratorium on deporting, or the moratorium that was in effect on deporting young adults who have been here and came here as children, many of whom came here and didn't even know, perhaps, that they were not U.S. citizens, but they've been here their entire lives, and now they're young adults, and this is the only country they've known. That, by the way, that executive order only protects children who were brought here before they were age 16. And what you have in many families is you will have children who are undocumented because they came here very young, and then other siblings who were born in the United States and as a result of that are citizens. So in any event, that is something that is going to be controversial for a long time. People have various views, and of course, I think some of us who are very sympathetic are sympathetic because we know of people who came here to avoid persecution. And unfortunately, people from Latin America who came here to avoid persecution and death, including many people who came here from Guatemala and many of the people from the Indian communities, really were escaping the horrible, horrible things that were going on in Guatemala. And they came here for political asylum, but they were denied political asylum, and were told that they were just coming here for economic benefits. And, of course, that wasn't true for the people who were coming here from Iron Curtain countries because of they were escaping communism. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't have been granted political asylum. However, it was really very unfair that people escaping from places like Guatemala were not afforded the same rights. But that goes back to a lot of prejudice, and we won't go into that because all we're talking about are legal issues. And as I said, the California bill is a significant bill. So what happens, what's happening in New Jersey? Well, the New Jersey Supreme Court on Wednesday blocked one class action lawsuit alleging a fraudulent drink pricing scheme against one restaurant chain, but allowed a similar action to move forward in another case. So that was very, you know, probably very interesting from the standpoint of, you know, why, and people would have to certainly read the cases to understand what the difference was and why the difference. And I will talk about that case, the cases, I guess, somewhat more. And in fact, what we're dealing with is the case Deborah Dugan versus TGI Fridays. And, of course, we have a TGI Fridays here in Flemington. And then it was Ernest Vozai versus OSI Restaurant Partners. So the Supreme Court, the opinion written by Justice Patterson, this was the decision. Because CFA class action jurisprudence rejects, and this is, quote, price inflation, end quote, theories, such as the theory presented by the Dugan plaintiffs, as incompatible with CFA's terms, the Dugan's plaintiffs have not established predominance with respect to their CFA claims. Now, however, the Bozies' allegations focus primarily on a specific pricing practice. So, therefore, the court found that if the Bozie class is redefined to include only customers who make that specific CFA claim, and the claim is limited accordingly, then the plaintiff Bozie has met the requirements of Rule 4:32-1 and may attempt to prove that claim on behalf of the class. And then as to other claims in both appeals, plaintiffs have failed to satisfy the predominance requirement of the Rule 4:32-1. So both of these cases, they were class action cases. There was a lead plaintiff, and then it was a class action case against TGI Fridays and OSI Restaurants. And that's how the way the claims or the complaints were filed is why there was a difference between the two cases. So that the plaintiff and plaintiffs and the class and OSI may actually be able to go forward as a class action suit. Now, there was a tax question. The tax court, this was Hanover Floral Company versus East Hanover Township, and so this would be of interest to various businesses. In this case, a taxpayer's payment of taxes on a lot not under the taxpayer's ownership is a mistake. So I guess they paid taxes on a lot that they didn't own. And that's a mistake within the meaning of the statute NJSA, New Jersey Statutes Annotated, 54:4-54. And that merited a refund of the current year taxes as well as three prior years. And then the tax court acknowledged that the relief awarded the taxpayer is limited by another case, noting that the court's disagreement with that portion of the holding. In other words, there was a holding in the appellate division under CRAME, C-E-R-A-M-E, versus Township Committee of Middletown, actually, excuse me. And that was reported at 349 New Jersey Super 486, an appellate division case in 2002. So that limited the current year as well as only three prior years. And so that although the tax court in this case acknowledged that the relief, they did grant relief, but only granted relief to the taxpayer that was limited under the prior case. And as I recall, the prior case, and I don't remember the reasons, but limited the refund only to the current year taxes plus three prior years. So in this case, Hanover Floral Company, I'm not sure, I haven't read the entire case, I'm not sure how many years they paid taxes under that on a lot that they didn't own. And I think everybody would agree that that was a mistake. You wouldn't pay taxes on a lot unless you thought you owned it. So interesting case from a standpoint of what you can do if, in fact, you found out that you didn't own a lot that you were paying taxes on. So there was another case this week, an administrative law case on taxation that was approved for publication. And this was Rosanna Pruitt-Stevens versus the Township of Toms River. And this is another tax court case. And then in that case, the court determined that the terms widow and widower define a person and not a marital status. So that in this case, the surviving spouse of a 100% disabled veteran is eligible for the veteran's exemption during widowhood or widowerhood. In other words, as long as they're a widow and or widower. And they can do that if they meet the requirements set forth in the statute, and that's a very specific statute, NJSA 54:4-3.31. And that includes certification that the surviving spouse has not remarried, so that the what has happened, obviously, if the surviving spouse is of a 100% disabled veteran, they're only eligible if, in fact, they have not remarried. So in this case, the court concludes that there is sufficient ambiguity as to whether this term has not remarried indicates a present or past marital status. And then the court determined that the legislative intent was that it represented present marital status. And as such, in this case, the spouse's exemption is available during periods when the surviving spouse is not married. So basically, what they're saying is if a surviving spouse gets remarried and then is divorced, that would be the issue. And so in this case, they also determined that fundamental fairness requires that consideration of a surviving spouse's marital status should not commence until the VA has determined the veteran's 100% disability. If at that time the surviving spouse is unmarried, the eligibility requirement has been met. So from a practical standpoint, the way this case was decided, and I have not read the case in total, but it appears from this information that if, in fact, a surviving spouse would remarry and then have that spouse either die or be divorced, and then thereafter the VA determines the veteran's 100% disability, as long as the surviving spouse is not married at that time, the surviving spouse would be eligible under this law. Interesting. And I guess I will have to read more. Or if anybody is really interested in the case, that case is published, and so it was decided on October, I believe it was decided on October 4th. So you can find that case, read it. It would be significant only in a case where someone is a surviving spouse of a veteran who's 100% disabled. But it's a significant benefit. So that certainly for that limited number of people, I would assume they would really take that into consideration if they're getting remarried. And for example, that would be something if I was called on to do a premarital agreement, and if in fact one of the people entering into the marriage is a surviving spouse of someone who's of a 100% disabled veteran, I would certainly let them know that they're going to be giving up this benefit, and could be a fairly significant benefit, and I would at least suggest that that be part of the negotiation of a premarital agreement, because I think that if, in fact, they're married, at that point, if they're a qualified beneficiary, as a surviving spouse, once they get remarried, they obviously would lose that. So it could make a significant difference as to whether somebody wants to get remarried. And I know this sounds strange, but people do take things like that into consideration. What could they lose, if they're remarried? And it really is important for someone who is entering into a second or third or fourth marriage to look into the benefits of having a premarital agreement. I frankly am surprised at how few people do that, and it is especially important if they have children, and what kind of planning are you going to do? What kind of conversations should people have? And I think so often they neglect to even think about those conversations. And of course, if they're holding premarital assets, they also need to know how they can protect those assets in case the new marriage doesn't work out. I know those of us who are divorce attorneys are always thinking of the what-ifs and what can happen, etc. But I think that these are things that people do have to think about. I would be suspicious if a young couple, one person in a young couple, first marriage, wants a premarital agreement. Now, I would say that it depends, of course. If someone has a business, a successful business, they might need a premarital agreement or certainly should think about it. And the other, I've often done premarital agreements in situations where there's a lot of, family money, family trusts, and they want to be sure that there's not a problem if, in fact, the young couple divorces. And, in fact, I was talking to someone just recently, and they're involved in a case where I think it was like an eight-month marriage, and, it's just a nightmare. Now, one person is making it a nightmare. I recognize that. But, the other spouse really just has to go through the entire process, like it or not. So let me come back after talking and letting you hear a few spots for some of our sponsors. And, if you don't need the first one, well, I guess maybe this is actually a new sponsor. So let me play about three or four commercials, and then I'll be back.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on 100 in Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@100-chamber.org.
Thank goodness they took the ad for the diets off. And I always like to hear Chris. So, yes, the Chamber is really a great organization for anybody who's in business or professionals. And it's a great way to meet people and to find out what's going on in our community.
This is Chamber President Chris Phelan inviting you to the 29th Annual Business and Home Expo with our Restaurant Showcase. This wonderful event will happen on Thursday, November 9th at our new location, Next Level Arena on Case Boulevard in Flemington from 2 to 7 p.m. If you're a business or organization and would like to participate, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or visit our website at 100inchamber.org.
And if you've never been to an expo, it's a great place to meet local businesses and get some good food and run into people you haven't run into for a few years. So really, even if you're not a business person or are a business person, if you are not displaying at the expo, come meet all of us.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, 100inchamberradio.com, brought to you by the 100in County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Pat and Heidi and Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Pat and Heidi and Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
This is Chamber President Chris Phelan inviting you to the 29th Annual Business and Home Expo with our Restaurant Showcase. This wonderful event will happen on Thursday, November 9th at our new location.
Wait a minute, Chris. I love you, but I just did that spot, and now you're having me do two at a time. No. Let's get back to It's the Law. I'm Pat Smits, and, let's go back in here and see what is happening in the legal news. There is a case where actually it was not published, and it's under initials TCVENM. So it was an appellate division case. Well, why are cases reported or not reported using initials rather than parties' names? Well, it's done when there's a sense of the need to protect children or some other area where there's no need to have the parties' names, but it would be either embarrassing or it's usually significant because most cases, for example, divorce cases, when they're printed and published, they will use the parties' names. So it's, Smith versus Smith, whatever the name, the usual thing is that they actually use the parties' names, even in divorce cases. So the and for example, there's a recent medical malpractice, although it was not approved from publication, it did have, in fact, the names of the plaintiff and defendant. In this case, the medical malpractice, the defendant was a pain management specialist. So that the defendant's name was, in fact, published, and so anybody can read about that. And I believe that was a male. So find out what his name is. But the family law case I'm talking about with the initials, parents... the parties were never married. They were the parents of twins. And in this case, the children were born in 1996. And the appellant, so he lost at the trial level, and he moved for emancipation of the children. And then the respondent mother filed a motion for contribution towards the children's college expenses and recalculation of child support. So the one question is, well, does it make a difference whether or not the parents were married? And the answer is no. In other words, there is a support obligation for children. Has no effect whether or not the parents were ever married. It has to do with the parents' incomes. Excuse me. So in this case, based on the party's income, assets, and debts, as well as father's raising four other children, the family part judge determined that the parties would not be able to support the college expenses of the twins. Nevertheless, since they both wanted their children to receive a college education and the children were progressing academically, the judge considered the Newberg factors. These are the factors related to whether or not parents should be responsible to pay college expenses. And the trial judge found that they should share the financial burden for the daughter, but the son's expenses, so the twins were one, a girl and a boy, so the son's expenses were covered by his student loans. And yet, since the son was still living with his mother and was no longer having overnight visits with his father, the father's obligation to pay child support for him remained. So in other words, in this case, the trial judge said, I'm not going to require you to pay for the son's college. His student loans can do that. But you're going to have to continue to pay child support. And, of course, that is a situation and statute in New Jersey and case law in New Jersey that for children who are attending college but still living at home, they are not emancipated and a child support obligation continues. So in this case, the family part judge reduced the amount by 20% to reflect the appellant's financial situation, and that's permitted by NJSA 2A:34-23. So on appeal, the court affirmed that the decision was supported by adequate, substantial, and credible evidence. That's what the appellate courts do. Even if an appellate court would say, well, we might have decided this differently, they have to look at the findings of fact and conclusions of law made by the trial court. And as long as the decision is supported by adequate, substantial, and credible evidence, they will uphold it. Now, in this case, although the court appreciated the parents' payments of their children's college education, and that was an expensive undertaking that required significant sacrifice, the judgment of the trial court was, in fact, affirmed substantially for the reasons cited by the family court judge. So that even though in this case it was going to be a significant burden, and especially for the appellant who is raising, meaning the father, who is raising four other children, that was going to be a significant burden. And I guess in some ways the courts would say, wait a minute, if you're going to have six children, you better understand that you're going to have a support obligation for all of them. And that is, in fact, the situation. And a problem, of course, is when there's a support order in another state and someone is paying child support to children who are living in another state, then has a situation where they're going to have to pay child support for children here in New Jersey. And many years ago, it used to be, at least in New Jersey, if someone had a child in New Jersey paying child support, children were not treated equally. Now they should be treated equally. So there was a student who was injured in gym class fall, and there was an $8 million verdict in that case, and that was an Essex County case, and an Essex County jury awarded $8 million in the case of a middle school student whose left arm was seriously injured when she tripped during a gym class. But the jury's apportionment of 25% comparative liability to the plaintiff brought her recovery to $6 million. In other words, they said that the school was 75% negligent and the child's was 25%. So therefore, the award due nearly 15% from what we hear. Well, this is obviously the most powerful proof that you know, those of us who are attorneys can provide most of the proof if we can provide graphics and other things. That would be the key to good advocacy, and anything you know, that we read is helpful. One of the things that I've always questioned, frankly, based on this, is that jurors, ordinarily jurors in New Jersey, are not allowed to take notes. And it was always surprising to me, because I know that I am a note taker, and if I take notes, you know, then I can go back, look at my notes, and I really will recall so much more than if I just listen to something and expect to, you know, remember what was said. And apparently, the argument against taking notes is that the person who takes notes, the juror who takes notes, might unduly influence other jurors, or that the notes could be incorrect. My response to that is that the jury can always ask for testimony to be read back if they had different recollections of what they heard. But again, if you were a juror and one of you is taking notes, assuming that you take good notes, and another is relying on their memory from what was said, I guess most of us would realize that the person who took notes is probably have a much more, that person would have a much better recollection based on their notes compared to somebody who had just heard because they were listening to the testimony. So the, let's see, what else are we of interest this week? The drug maker, Allergan, A-L-L-E-R-G-A-N, Allergan, has been hit with a lawsuit in federal court in Newark, accusing it of scheming to block Medicare prescription plans from covering a drug made by its competitor, Shire U.S., and this is a drug for treating dry eyes. And and you may know how to pronounce this better than I do, but they're the maker of Restasis, and I think we certainly, that's pretty commonly known that, you know, we hear about Restasis. There's a lot of commercials, et cetera, but they were able to exclude Shire's competing drug, and no wonder nobody's heard of it. It's XIIDRA, extra, from Medicare Part B, no, excuse me, Part D plans by offering administrators substantial discounts on a wide range of other drugs that would be lost if, I guess, extra was allowed, if extra were allowed on their formularies, the suit claimed. So anyway, this is a lawsuit that is alleging that they're accused of scheming to block Medicare prescription plans from covering this drug made by a competitor. So as more governments across the nation sue dozens of drug companies to claw back money spent battling opioid addiction, one lawyer has moved to transfer all of these cases to a single federal court. Be interesting, because there are so many of these cases that are being filed and pending. And, of course, we all know that the opioid addiction crisis is huge, and there's a lot of concern that, you know, many people addicted became addicted because of legal prescription drug use. So that apparently there's a lot of false claim acts coming up. Lots of cases that are unpublished, but not a lot that have been published. And I've said before that I really think that there should be more cases that are published. There's a, by the way, a federal judge has awarded two law firms in New Jersey, including New Jersey, two law firms including New Jersey's Mandelbaum Salzburg, nearly $750,000 in fees and costs after a series of disputes, commercial disputes, and lots of money. So, and I think I may have reported last week that the Kirkland and Ellis and Kutak Rock are joining, partnered up in the Toys R Us bankruptcy that is going to be huge. I mean, just, you know, huge. Some number of family law cases that have been reported. Have been unreported. And, the majority of cases really are not reported for publication. And so they cannot be used as precedent. They're very helpful. And as I said, I think that more cases should be published because they actually can be very helpful when you come up with a case with pretty much the same, fairly close, and you have a very good decision. One of our judges, one of our trial judges, Judge Jones, was, you know, really authored excellent decisions at the trial level. And unfortunately, he retired and is now doing a lot of consulting and doing other things in family law. But his decisions were very helpful. Many of them actually were published. That's unusual. Going back years ago, we had Judge Kraft, who had a lot of published cases. Judge Sarko also had some published cases. But most trial judges really do not submit their cases for publication, or if they do and they're not published, they stop doing it because it's honestly so much more work. Not that the judges don't write good opinions, but they... To write an opinion that's going to be published is even more work. As I said, there's another, there are a couple family law cases actually that have initials because they're because they involve children, and that's as I said, that's usually when we have cases published with initials or unpublished. I mean, it doesn't have to be just published cases because all cases are now reported, whether they're published or unpublished. There's a new, as New Jersey's new bail system continues to get a shakeout because it was such a significant change, the appeals court ruled that a defendant's pregnancy cannot be the overriding factor in deciding whether or not to release her pending trial. So what happens is, in these cases, there are pre-trial detention hearings. And in this case, approved for publication, State of New Jersey versus Amani Williams. And this is the appellate division case. And so in this appeal, the appellate division addressed whether in a pretrial detention hearing, the defendant's pregnancy should be given greater consideration than any other pretrial detention factor in a judgment's assessment under the Criminal Justice Reform Act. Anybody interested in it, called the act, it's NJSA 2A:162-15-26. So at the detention hearing, in this case, the trial judge noted the defendant's extensive juvenile history, her current second-degree charges, and multiple failures to appear, and considered the pretrial services recommendation for no release. Although stating that all pertinent factors under the statute weighed, and that was in basically 160 NJSA 2A colon 162-20, weighed in favor of detention. So the trial judge said all of the factors under the statute weighed in favor of detention. However, the trial judge concluded that the defendant's eight-week pregnancy required her release with conditions. So there was an appeal. And in this case, the appellate division held that because the trial judge abused his discretion in giving defendant's pregnancy greater weight than all other pertinent factors in his determination to release her, the appellate division reversed. So in these cases, in these pre-trial detention hearings, the court has to consider all factors as equal. And so what the appellate division said is pregnancy, like any other medical condition, is considered only for its impact on the risk of a defendant posing a danger to the community, obstructing justice, or failing to appear in court. So that would be the way that pregnancy could be considered a factor, just like any other medical condition would. Interesting case. It is an interesting case. And in this case, because of the extensive criminal, I guess I should say, history, including juvenile, of this particular defendant, and the judge actually said, based on all those other factors, he would not release her. And then did, because of the pregnancy, appellate division said no. So there was a case, the appellate court on Wednesday issued a ruling ruling on an unemployment compensation benefits. And that stands in direct contrast with another appellate decision from a few weeks prior. So that case now, will most likely go up to the Supreme Court. And because that's what happens if, in fact, there are two different panels decide the same issue and they decide it differently, those are cases that the Supreme Court takes up and makes a decision. Actually, it's a little surprising that there would be two that different, because usually they're very, it's very unusual that one appellate division panel doesn't follow another one. Okay, let's see. Well, we have a few more minutes. So there was an interesting case. Interesting case for in family law with respect to ethics, and in that case, there was a divorce case. And the appellant husband and non-party wife, and so the. In this case, the respondent was one of the wife's lawyers, and they sent filings in the divorce litigation to the Wall Street Journal, and that resulted in their widespread publication. And so the appellant filed suit for abuse of process, libel, invasion of privacy, and civil conspiracy. And then the respondent moved for and was granted dismissal of the complaint for failure to state a claim and to strike particular paragraphs related to false domestic violence allegations leveled against the appellant. So on appeal, the court affirmed dismissal of the abuse of process but reversed dismissal of the remaining counts, as well as reversing the striking of the paragraphs. So in this case, the court found that the paragraphs were relevant because the facts alleged were of they were of consequence to the determination of the action. And the court noted that the paragraph supported motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, and plan between the alleged conspirators. So anyway, this, one of the concerns, in fact, I had a call today from a potential client whose wife has threatened that if he files divorce, she's going to ruin him professionally. And it would be just malicious. But, of course, in this case, the wife said that she was going to send letters and basically photographs that are doctored to other professionals that he has contact with. It would be extremely harmful if she would do that. And, of course, what people should not do in any divorce case is try to extract revenge. Cases, for example, where one spouse will send out pictures, that inappropriate pictures on the internet, all of these things, certainly in that case, it can be harassment, it can be, those are not the way ways to do things. It's just not. Well, there was what else? So some criminal law cases. In this case, community, the issue was community supervision for life. The case J.S. versus the New Jersey State Parole Board. And in this case, the appeal is subject, or the appellant is subject to the community supervision for life. That's called the CSL, Community Supervision for Life, and that's under the Violent Predator that's under NJSA 2C43-6-4. And he applied to live in Sweden with his wife and children, and that was denied by the parole board, which treated it as a request to terminate CSL. So the court in this case, the appellate division, reverses and remands to the parole board to consider the merits of his application, including whether the parole board could supervise or monitor his compliance with the conditions of CSL, Community Supervision for Life, or impose special conditions. So, this is obviously rather unusual. He was looking to move to live in Sweden. A case that comes to mind, of course, is the recent release of, I'm blanking on who I'm talking about, O.J. Simpson. Recently, O.J. Simpson was released from prison in Nevada, and he at least has some supervision. I don't know that that would be supervision for life, in other words, community supervision for life, but I do know that there was an issue of whether or not he would be able to move to Florida from Nevada, because Florida would have to agree to take over his parole. He is out on parole. He was released on parole before the end of his sentence, which means since it's an early release, he will be on parole as part of the release. And as such, there has to be a parole board that will, in fact, supervise. So, for example, if somebody is released from prison in New Jersey, they would have to remain in New Jersey unless another state would agree to supervise their parole. And in this case, this man had, he was released subject to community supervision for life, which is obviously pretty significant. He wants to move not only out of state, he wants to move out of the country. So the trial judge said, no, there's no possibility. And then the appellate division said, well, send it back and take another look and see if there's some way that this could be worked out. Well, that's the program today. I'm Pat Smits. I've been bringing you information about legal cases and the law. We'll be back after the news break with the sports guys.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon.
Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org. The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News with Jason Wirt.
All of America is praying for the wounded and the grieving, and we will be with them today, and we will be with them forever.
President Trump's comments today regarding the shooting in Las Vegas, where the girlfriend of the gunman now giving new details. Mary Lou Danley told investigators Stephen Paddock showed some symptoms of mental illness. She says she remembers him lying in bed, moaning and screaming. State and federal law enforcement officials confirmed Paddock had been prescribed anti-anxiety medication in the past. The Trump administration undoing a federal mandate on birth control. The Obamacare rule required employers to provide contraceptive coverage in health insurance plans. The new rule will allow more employers and insurers to exempt themselves for moral and religious reasons. Millions of women currently have free access to contraceptives because of the federal mandate. The rollback expected to be challenged in court. USA Radio News.
Smart players in Las Vegas know you build your football bankroll for the weekend by winning money on Friday night. You've seen the sports gambling movie that Hollywood made called Two for the Money, starring Al Pacino and Matthew McConaughey. Oscar winner McConaughey played the role of the world's most successful professional sports handicapper, Brandon Lang, the guy who's a documented 21-3 lifetime with his Super Bowl plays. Hollywood only makes movies about winners, and tonight Brandon Lang can make you a winner with his Friday Night College Game of the Year. There are two games on tap, Memphis, Connecticut, and Boise, BYU. One of them is his Friday Night Game of the Year, and you can get it absolutely free by texting the word FRIDAY to 30838. No salesman, no hassles,